talking history. This is News Talk.
We shall fight on the beaches, we shall fight in the hills, we shall never surrender.
And out of that silence came thousands of voices.
The strategy of the white man has always been divide and conquer.
As one small step for man, one giant leap for mankind.
Auch die Rollen, Argus, Akhoisa.
The history book on the shelf is always repeating itself. Good evening and welcome. We're talking history on News Talk 106 to 108 with me, Patrick Gagan. Tonight's show is on the winning of the Eurovision 50 years ago in April 1974 by ABBA. And we'll be finding out how the song Waterloo helped propel them to global superstardom. You can email us your thoughts and views, talkinghistory@newstalk.com, and we'd love to hear from you. Last week, we marked the centenary of the founding of the Irish judicial system and the creation of our courts. And if you want to listen back to this or to any of our older shows, just go to the News Talk app powered by Go Loud, our website newstalk.com, or wherever you download your podcasts. Tonight's show is on ABBA's Eurovision victory 50 years ago. The 19th Eurovision Song Contest took place in Brighton on the 6th of April 1974. 17 countries took part with the winning entry from Sweden, the quartet ABBA and their song Waterloo. The song became a hit around the world and helped propel ABBA to global superstardom, and they became one of the most successful bands of all time. At the height of their fame, the band consisted of two married couples, but these relationships ended in divorce and the band stopped performing together in 1982. In tonight's show, we want to go back in time 50 years to the Eurovision and the rise of the global phenomenon that is ABBA. And to help me do this, I'm delighted to welcome our panel of experts. Carl Magnus Palm is the world's leading ABBA historian and has devoted more than three decades to researching and writing about ABBA, including 8 written or co-written books, and he's the author of ABBA on Record. Hedley Swain is the CEO of the Royal Pavilion and Museums Trust and has lectured and published widely on museum and archaeology matters. And the Trust is currently running the ABBA exhibition, ABBA One Week in Brighton, at Brighton Museum. Ing-Marie Halling is the creative director and curator at ABBA the Museum in Sweden and was the band's makeup artist, costume assistant and all-round travelling companion through the three headiest years of their fame. Dr. Donal Mulligan lectures at the DCU School of Communications and is an expert on digital media analysis, design and production, and also he's an expert on the Eurovision Song Contest. Well, you're all very welcome. And Donal, I might begin with you. And I might begin with the fact that when people think about Eurovision or talk about Eurovision, probably the most iconic winner of all time probably is ABBA and Waterloo 50 years ago.
I think very much so. And I think provably so, in that recently when the 50th anniversary of Eurovision happened, there was a vote on people's favourite song and Waterloo won quite easily, I think, in that case. There's something about the song, I think the particular wall of sound opening to it, those opening chords, I think kind of grab people and are extremely memorable to a lot of people who've heard it at all.
And it was a very interesting song contest because you had Olivia Newton-John representing the United Kingdom. You had France absent because Georges Pompidou had died and there was the funeral. And tell us about Italy and its entry, because the Italians didn't broadcast the Eurovision for a whole month.
Yeah, Italy came second that year, but the Italians wouldn't know that because it was not shown live in Italy. And that's because the song was called Sì, Yes. And there was a referendum at the time. And so they felt that it was much like many of the scandals we've had since around Eurovision. It was a politically motivated song. I'm not sure I agree, but the Italian government certainly thought so. And so they wouldn't let it be shown in Italy or be heard in Italy for a month until the referendum happened.
Which again shows how the world was 50 years ago, because now with streaming and the internet and social media and everything, there is no way that people would not. You'd probably find more people watching it in Italy through all these other methods. Carl, can I talk to you about the band itself then, ABBA, how it formed, the four members, how they chose their name, and I suppose the fact that this was their second go at Eurovision because they had tried to get the nomination for Sweden in 1973.
Yeah, that is correct. The story of how ABBA formed is quite long, but I'll try to make it compact here for this this program. They'd all been famous in the 1960s, and then they came together as, you know, they happened to meet up in the late 60s, and they started these romantic relationships. And Björn and Benny, as songwriters, had this dream to reach outside Sweden or Scandinavia with pop music. So for that reason, they started working with the ladies, because they recognized, obviously, that, you know, Agneta and Frida could sing a lot better than they could. So they wanted to work with them, record pop music in English with them. And so ABBA was formed as an experiment at first in 1972. It wasn't like, because they were so busy with everything else they were doing as individuals. They were just like, you know, let's try this. They recorded a song called People Need Love in 1972. And that was the start of ABBA. I mean, and they weren't even called ABBA at the time. They were called Björn and Benny, Agneta and Annifrid. And as I don't have to tell you, with that name, it would be very difficult for them to have an international career. So it was their manager, Stig Anderson, who sort of just for fun took the initials of all their, you know, their first names. So ABBA, Agneta, Björn, Benny and Annifrid. And so he came up with that name. And the group, they weren't really that happy about it at first, because in Sweden there's something else called ABBA, which is a, you know, a herring factory, canned fish factory. So they felt like, are people going to think about canned fish when they listen to our music? Not so good. But he persuaded them that outside Sweden, that wouldn't matter. It, you know, it was a good name, it was short, it could be pronounced in every language. So anyway, in 1973, they entered Melodifestivalen, which is the Swedish selection for the Eurovision Song Contest, with a song called Ring Ring. Which actually was the favorite to win that year. Everyone thought that was going to win because it was so catchy. But for some reason or other, because there was an expert jury of you know, music business professionals, they thought, that's not a very, very sophisticated song. So it only finished third. So and they were very, very disappointed. And Stig Anderson was very angry. But, you know, they licked their wounds and came back a year later, and the rest is history.
And the rest is history. And was there that iconic branding, the logo, was that there from the beginning as well? The way the first B is that kind of mirror image, and because that kind of helped create a kind of an identity for them as well?
It was not. It was invented a couple of years after Eurovision in 1976. By that time, they'd struck up a relationship, a working relationship and friendship with a designer called Rune Söderqvist, who did all ABBA sleeves from Arrival onwards. And he, because he was working in the world of advertising, and he felt, you know, this group needs a logo, because it was a free for all, you know, internationally with how the group name was designed and presented. And he felt they should have a proper logo. And he thought, well, you know, they are two couples. One A belongs with one B, and so on, vice versa. So each B should be turned towards one of the A's. And that's how that came up.
And I think they were maybe fortunate as well in that the rules for Eurovision had changed around that period, where you could perform in English rather than your native language. And it was changed again after that. And it only, I think, was in the last, you know, 25 years or so that they returned to that rule. So I think it probably helped them that the song was being performed in English.
Oh, absolutely. Oh, definitely. I mean, I think those rules changed back and forth over the years. I mean, Donald will know more about this, but they were lucky that that particular year in 1974 they were allowed to sing in English. It would have been a disaster, I think, if they would have been forced to perform it in Swedish. It wouldn't have had the same impact.
Hedley, the Eurovision was staged in the United Kingdom, in Brighton, in 1974, but the UK hadn't won it the previous year. So how did that come about?
Absolutely. It was one of those weird occasions. Luxembourg had won it and said they didn't want to host it. And it's whatever you think of the Brits, we often step in, don't we? You know, as we did with the Ukraine one. So Britain, UK stepped in and said they would host it. And it wasn't even sure that it was going to be at Brighton. They then had to find a venue, and looking through the papers, you know, the Albert Hall was considered at one stage, which might be thought of as a more appropriate location. But in the end, the Brighton Dome offered. And those of you who know Brighton, I mean, of course, Brighton is a very musical city. The Dome is a great venue, but it's not a huge venue, and it's a sign of the times how almost you know, domestic the whole thing was in those days, in sort of, you know, going to local music shops to find some of the equipment and only a few cameras coming down, and, you know, most of the audience being invited. But once it was going to be in Brighton, it was a good marriage. You know, Brighton is a very musical place. It, you know, it has a sort of jolly seaside air to it. So it was suddenly seen as, you know, a great place to have it. And it's definitely, you know, remembered very, very fondly. As you know, when we put together this exhibition, we thought about different ways of doing it, and in the end we did it as a sort of piece of social history, where we did a sort of call out, and it was amazing how many people who are still around 50 years on who remembered really distinctly, or involved in some way, or, you know, their careers started as singers because, you know, they witnessed ABBA in the garden, the Pavilion Gardens, or saw it on the telly the day before. It was a lucky quirk of fate that Britain got it, even lovely that Brighton got it, and amazing to be commemorating it this week, the anniversary.
And Hedley, it is interesting as well. There are two types of Eurovision fans: those who prefer the songs and the music and the performance and the spectacle, and then those who prefer the voting. And I've always been fascinated by the voting and the different ways it changes over the years, and jury panels and getting the public to decide. But looking back on the voting in 1974, and it was quite a convincing win for ABBA, but I was somewhat shocked and surprised to see that the UK gave the infamous null point to ABBA, and that does seem a little surprising.
As you know, Olivia Newton-John was kind of favourite, and I think the Brits, you know, probably had an eye to that. She was incredibly popular. Hindsight is this wonderful thing, isn't it? I mean, I'm married to a Swede. Waterloo was our wedding song. Every time I see that bit of film, and as you can imagine, I've seen it an awful lot recently, you can't not think this is one of the most amazing pop songs ever. But at the time, as you've already said, it wasn't necessarily the favourite. And the odds for it winning actually were getting worse as it got, you know, the last few days. Benny went out and put a bet on it winning, you know, quietly went to one of the local betting shops in Brighton. So whether the UK gave it no points because they had an eye on Olivia Newton-John winning, you know, relations with Sweden and the UK have always been incredibly good. But you're absolutely right. It didn't. But it is with that amazing hindsight that it's such an amazing song and has become so powerful. And as you said earlier, you know, more recently, the UK have voted it the great Eurovision song ever.
Yeah, it's possible that the UK voters then were historical purists, and they didn't like the fact that there was that historical inaccuracy that at Waterloo, Napoleon didn't in fact surrender. It was a few weeks after, and that maybe they were just being absolutely precise about it. Ing-Marie, I think ABBA and Waterloo, it looked different in 1974 to other Eurovision songs and even other Eurovision entries around that time. The style was different. Maybe the performance was different. There was a kind of a different sense of energy with the whole band.
Yeah, it really, you're absolutely right there. And every time I see this film from the Dome, it's so exciting to see the sign of the times. You know, when you see the audience in the tuxedos and long dresses and applauding very, you know, posh style of the whole look in the place. And of course, the four members of the group decided early that if they're going to do this, they want to be seen and heard. no one will forget it, forget them. And they succeeded because the costumes didn't look like anything else in the contest. And the song as well, this catchy, a bit rocky song, I think. So the whole glam rock style of the whole thing, of course, made a mark. A clever move, I would say.
Donald, what was the Eurovision like in 1974? Was it as big around Europe the way it is now? Like, it certainly seems to become this massive, huge spectacle now. I wonder, how was it seen back in the 1970s?
I think that description is really good of the kind of genteel applause and the tuxedos. It was a very different competition. And I think ABBA are really one of the groups that redefine what it later becomes. They certainly have a huge legacy throughout the later competition in terms of it becoming much more about pop and much more about a kind of contemporary music. A lot of the winning pieces are quite serious up to that point. The amount of countries taking part are much smaller. So you talked about the voting there. There's only around a dozen countries voting in 1974. And the, you know, ABBA wins that year with 24 points. For context, last year when the win happened, it was 583 points. So, I mean, we're in very, very different kind of systems of voting and very different numbers of countries voting. It's an entirely transformed contest now, of course.
And has there always been, it seems a rare enough occurrence when a band will or a singer will win Eurovision and then go on to huge success and huge fame, that very often they can be pigeonholed by the Eurovision and they can have a certain amount of success, but never quite maybe make the breakthrough into the wider glory. But ABBA very certainly achieved that.
Hugely so, yeah. And I mean, yeah, for every ABBA, there's a, you know, the Johnny Logan kind of version that we have, where there's, you know, limited success perhaps in other European countries or whatever, but the scale of the worldwide phenomenon that ABBA became is really, I think, unique in the context. There's nothing that sits alongside them in terms of the scope of their majesty afterwards.
Ah, yeah, but no disrespect to Johnny, though. Like, we love Johnny Logan. Like, two fantastic wins performing and then wrote a winner. So, Johnny deserves a show on Talking History himself. And Hedley, you have some wonderful exhibits there at the exhibition, like things like the drum kit that they sourced for the band at the last minute, some of the costumes, all of these information, an interview even with the taxi driver who I think drove them to London after the win. Like, there are these wonderful items and artifacts that connect us to that story.
Yeah, indeed. And, you know, going back, you know, that decision we made to make it very much a social history story. And it did come across at how sort of slightly kitchen sink and domestic it all was. You know, the Dome, as I said, it's a beautiful venue, but it's not a huge venue. When Britain again got it last year, you know, Brighton said, well, obviously we need to get it back. There is no longer a venue in Brighton that would take Eurovision. And everything was done, you know, put together. And the story of the drum kit is a really good story. So the instruments, I don't think I'm giving anything away to say that the instruments weren't actually played on stage. You know, there was a backing track, but they needed instruments as props. And the Dome said, "Oh, we will provide the drum kit." And they went to the one big music shop that was then in Brighton on the Western Road, and they couldn't provide a drum. And the manager just remembered that the two chaps across the road in the furniture shop were drummers, Larry and Peter. So he went over and spoke to Larry and Peter and said, "Oh yeah, we've got a drum." So Larry lent a drum kit, and that was the drum kit that was used that night, and is in the film. And then it went back afterwards, and then years later Larry sold it to his mate Pete, and then years later Pete gave it to his great grandson Zachary, and it sort of ended up in a garage somewhere. And that, again, when we decided we would do the exhibition, we put a call out, you know, across Brighton, and we said, look, you know, what are your memories? And And somebody turned up, oh, I've got the drum kit. And we couldn't believe this. And that was the story. And that's on display, the actual drum kit that was used that night.
And Carl, why do you think the band became such a global phenomenon after the Eurovision? Was it the quality of the songwriting and the singing and the music? Was it something to do with people being intrigued and fascinated by the interpersonal relationships between the four members? Was it something to do with the style and glamour and maybe almost capturing the zeitgeist of the 1970s? Like, is it possible to kind of identify the secrets of their success?
I'm tempted to say no, it's not, but I'll give it a go anyway. I mean, it's so hard to put the finger on it. Obviously, it's the music first and foremost, because they put such a lot of work into their music. I mean, they could spend weeks just trying to come up with one good song. And then they spent weeks in the studio trying to record it to the best of their abilities. And so that's why the music sounds so good today still, because they worked so hard on it at the time. And then, of course, you have the songs, and then the songs interact with the image of the two married couples and, you know, the crazy costumes they had during the first half of their career and all that. And it just becomes this is the ABBA package. And it was just perfect for the times. It just worked. The audience, a worldwide global audience, bought into that. It worked for them at the time. That's the best way I can phrase it.
And the band seems to be constantly rediscovered in every new generation, that the songs are still familiar now in the 21st century, 50 years on from that Eurovision, that through movies, through re-releases of the albums, through various different mediums, we see the songs reaching younger and newer generations.
Yeah, it's a testament again to the quality of the music, I think. Plus, of course, you have that kind of they came to symbolize the 70s in a way, with the costumes and with the way they presented themselves and the style of their music and the production values of the music. But some of the music from the 70s, if you go back to it, it sounds a bit dated, but ABBA's music doesn't. It sounds like it was recorded a long time ago, but it still sounds fresh. There is still the energy there that was there at the time, if you will. And through the Mamma Mia musical, through all these things that have happened during the last, 25, 30 years, their music has reached new generations. And when they've heard the songs in Mamma Mia, maybe they think, oh, you know, ABBA, who were they really? And how do the songs sound in their original versions? And then they go back there, and it's just incredible. I mean, I've been doing this for 3 decades now, and there's still, 15-year-olds, young people coming up in the fan community and, discovering ABBA and being absolutely besotted by them. It's incredible.
And Carl, why are you so fascinated? Is it because you are Swedish? You've also written about the Beatles and other singers and actresses. So what is it about ABBA that you keep coming back to?
Well, it all started out with the challenge, I think. That was one of the things, because when I started out, there was nothing really in-depth written about them out there. I think they were largely seen in a sort of musical historical context. They were largely seen as, oh, that great pop band from the 70s who put out a string of great singles. But it sort of stopped there. And I thought, well, there must be more to them, because they were so huge and their music is so great. There must be more to the story. And I think I've proved that there is more to the story. And ABBA themselves have proved, obviously. And there's still new information to find out. I still find new things in their story that is absolutely fascinating and mind-boggling.
Well, tonight we're talking history and we're talking about the Eurovision 50 years ago when ABBA won with Waterloo. And we're going to take a quick break now. When we come back, we'll be finding out about the relationships within the band, what went right and also what went wrong. So stay with us here on News Talk. Welcome back. We're talking history and it's the 50th anniversary of the Eurovision, the 50th anniversary of ABBA winning with Waterloo in 1974. And tonight we are talking about that iconic victory. I'm joined by a brilliant panel, Carl Magnus Palm, who's the world's leading ABBA historian, Hedley Swain, who's the CEO of the Royal Pavilion and Museums Trust. And the Trust is currently running a brilliant ABBA exhibition, ABBA 1 Week in Brighton at the Brighton Museum. Inge-Marie Halling, who's the creative director and curator at ABBA, the museum in Sweden, and she was the band's makeup artist, costume assistant and all-round travelling companion for 3 years. And Dr. Donal Mulligan, who lectures at the DCU School of Communications and is an expert on the Eurovision Song Contest. Inge-Marie, let's talk about the band then and what they were like and your involvement with them, your friendship with them, what it was like working with them. How exciting was that time of your life?
It's more exciting to look back on that time today, in hindsight, because at that time, we all in the crew, we were doing a job. We went on tour with the band, and going outside Sweden was big for us. But going to Australia as the first leg was, that was absolutely crazy for us. But still, it was a job. And it's now, after so many years, that you look back and realize how massive it was and what big experience it was for everyone, including the four members of the band. And as Swedes tend to be very caring with the people they work with, there's no hierarchy and things like that. So it was like, you know, traveling going on a vacation trip to Australia with a lot of friends. That's what we all felt afterwards. They really took good care of us and, you know, parties never started until the last rigger had done his job and things like that.
And Inge-Marie, they really seem to have had a strong sense of their own style, the image that they wanted to have. And they didn't seem to be too concerned with fashion or what look people expected, that they were quite prepared to do their own thing.
Yeah, that's absolutely right. I mean, they were concerned about fashion. I mean, both Benny and Frida cared a lot about their style and so on. But they never had anyone else telling them what to wear and how to look and what to say and what to do. They decided all that themselves, including ticket prices and everything. So they knew what they were doing. And I think that's the key to success is, you know what you want to do and follow your gut feeling. And they have done that the whole time, including ABBA Voyage.
And Inge-Marie, we do see when bands have to work together and go on tour together and be together for such long extended periods, there are tensions and they do fall out. We saw it with the Beatles. We saw it with, you know, two brothers in Oasis. And we also see it with ABBA as well, that it probably is too much to expect, you know, two marriages to survive and two relationships to survive when you're living together, working together with each other all that time, and the intensity of all of that, it probably is too much.
Yeah, but, you know, they never fell out. It wasn't fights or the story about the girls' cat fights. It's not true. I mean, they were very respectful to each other. And as a person working with makeup and costume, you get really, really close to the people. And I never, ever see anything like it. Very respectful. And, of course, they had the different opinions and things. But they always had this saying that if someone doesn't like to do this, then we don't do it. And that goes still today. I mean, ABBA Voyage wouldn't have been happening if one of them didn't like it, like the idea. So in that sense, they are a bit different from many artists. I've seen both the musical artists and the actors and dancers and everything. And it's a lot of tensions and crashes and, not so many nice situations, but with these four, that wasn't the case at all.
Donald, we've mentioned Australia, and ABBA, for some reason, were and are enormously popular in Australia. Why is that?
Uniquely, I think the Australians took to ABBA in a way that, you know, they of course had huge success in lots of countries, but it was especially enormous there. And I've seen reporting this, Benny described it as the 1977 concert that they gave in Sydney as his favourite, his most satisfying concert. And certainly the reception that they got there was really rapturous. And I think a lot of people now, these days, looking at Eurovision, wonder why Australia is there. And I would really say that ABBA is the reason why that occurred, because ABBA's success in Australia becomes so enormous, and that I think it's the spark for a lot of interest in Eurovision in Australia that lasts for years and years. It's also the reason that ABBA kind of has one of the big resurgences that it does in the 1990s is to do with the fact that two movies in 1994 that came out, Muriel's Wedding and Priscilla, Queen of the Desert, both really strongly feature ABBA. And in both of those cases, they kind of became cult hits that brought a huge new kind of cohort to the ABBA sound again. And so I think Australia has this very strong connection with the band culturally. And the band, I think, is something that kind of resonates for Australians in a stronger way for some reason.
And Donald, this was Sweden's first Eurovision victory, and they went on then to win many more times. Mm-hmm. I think they share the record for the most wins with Ireland. And did it shape and influence later Eurovision entries from Sweden and their style?
Yeah, very strongly, I think. So 10 years later is the next time they win, and they also win again on the 25th anniversary of ABBA winning. So in both of those cases, there's quite a lot of discussion at the time about the influence of ABBA and it being an important anniversary and people almost looking out for it. The 10-year later win is an interesting one. It's a song called Diggy Loo Diggy Lay, which again is a very, you know, strange sounding, very Eurovision type entry. But that beats Linda Martin for Ireland. And so it's one that a lot of people...
Terminal 3,
Linda's like almost Waz song. And a lot of people give the reason for the win as bound up in the fact that people wanted to celebrate the 10-year anniversary of ABBA. So ABBA already is so huge in the contest and following that people feel like, you know, there's something to be remembered there. And I think very strongly on the 25th anniversary in 1999, Charlotte Pirelli, enters again for Sweden, and her song really sounds like an ABBA song. It has a very, very similar kind of melody to ABBA. It has a very similar kind of wall of sound kind of setup in it as well. And so I think their influence, of course, has waned in more recent Swedish songs. And you know, we would not say that Loreen, for example, is really taking her cues from ABBA, but certainly in the longer history of the contest, it's very strongly resonating there.
So Eurovision isn't until next month. Does Sweden have a chance then on the 50th anniversary? Is there going to be a rush of nostalgia?
I wondered if Sweden would consciously nod to ABBA as they have done on the 10th and 25th anniversary. I don't think they have. So Martin and Martinus, I think, is the duo who are entering this year. It's a good song. It's a pop song, but I don't think it's going to squeak the win for them this time. I would be surprised, but I've been wrong about this almost every year that I've tried to predict it, so I'm not going to put too much money down.
Carl, they had this 8-year period of huge success until in 1982 they made that decision then to kind of go their separate ways. Do you think that was, I suppose, as much as you could expect from a band at that time, producing so much music, touring so much and all of that? Or were there kind of tensions there that were always going to burn them out?
Well, at the time, I think, I mean, it was the life expectancy of a pop group. I mean, some bands only lasted 3 or 4 years before they sort of imploded. With ABBA, I think they'd come full circle. You can almost hear it on the last album, The Visitors from 1981, and then the last few songs they recorded in 1982. You can almost hear that they've reached the end of the line, and they need new challenges. And that was absolutely true for Bjorn and Benny, because they wanted to try to write a musical, and that's what they did. And of course, obviously, because things had changed within the group, and maybe that spark wasn't quite there anymore. It was just, you know, everyone felt, let's take a break from this for a while. And then that break went on for several decades.
And people always talk about the song The Winner Takes It All because it's written about divorce. It seems that it was written very quickly. I think you know, there was clearly emotion there. They always denied that it was about the specifics of the relationships, but it's very hard to write a song about divorce if you've gone through a divorce without your own life and your own experience shaping it, and then having your ex-wife having to sing it. It adds an extra layer of complexity to the whole thing.
It does. It's not a literal depiction of what happened to them, because no one was a winner in that divorce. Both were losers, if anything, because they tried to keep their marriage together, but they couldn't. But of course, there is, I mean, Bjorn, I've spoken to Bjorn about this, and he says, well, there is a grain of reality in there, but then the rest is fiction, because obviously he was trying to write pop music lyrics, and that was his priority, not to pour his heart out. But then again, there is an emotional truth in the song. And he also told me that when he showed the lyrics to Agneta on the day when she was going to overdub her lead vocals, she didn't start crying exactly, but a tear or two, you know, fell from her eyes because she was emotionally affected by the lyrics. She didn't think it was about her and Bjorn literally either, but she could recognize the emotional truth of a breakup, which, you know, so that was what resonated with her, I think.
Ing-Marie, tell me about ABBA the Museum then, and the very powerful storytelling that you do there about the band.
Thank you. Yes, we decided from the start to do the chronological tour of the life of an ABBA, which means you go through the Swedish Folk Park where they all met and where they all toured as separate artists. And you go into this Vigse hut where Björn and Benny also wrote this Waterloo song. And we have the studio, a replica of the studio, and a place where you go and get your costumes, and then you can go up on stage and sing. And I think that's a good way to tell both of the context of the 70s, the colors and the shapes and the style, and also how their life were as artists. But we also have a little kitchen installation, which Björn was very keen on having. And that was Agneta's kitchen after the divorce. And they were friends. They had the children together, and they were sending her off to school. And in the radio in this kitchen, we also hear this song slipping through my fingers, which obviously was about Linda going to school for the first time. And you know, people, when they stop there and look at this, many people get tears in their eyes, because there isn't one single person in this world that hasn't gone through a separation. It can be a cat or a partner or whatever. But you know the feeling of a separation, and that's a good installation to tell about that. So I would say it's a very emotional museum in that sense.
And it captures the power of the story and the different elements that make up the real ABBA history.
Definitely, it does, yes.
Well, tonight we are talking history, and we are talking about the iconic victory of ABBA with their song Waterloo at the Eurovision 50 years ago. Well, we're going to take a quick break now. When we come back, we'll be talking about the wider cultural impact of ABBA's win, but we'll also be finding out about what exactly happened in Brighton. Terry Wogan providing the radio broadcast commentary again for the BBC, and lots more besides. So stay with us here on News Talk. Welcome back to Talking History. Tonight we are, of course, talking about the Eurovision win by ABBA with their song Waterloo 50 years ago. Hedley, let's go back again to Brighton. Talk to me about Terry Wogan, because I think this year he was doing the radio commentary. I think he had done the television the year before, and in this period he was kind of switching between the two. And he was there, you had international journalists there, and there seemed to be a huge amount of excitement around the place.
Brighton's a medium size. It's a party town. It's a seaside town, but it's not a huge town. So it was a really big deal to have Eurovision and to have the BBC cameras there, and there is one amazing photograph that someone's taken from the back, and the only people that are turning around and looking at it are the four members of ABBA. So we've got all these, and all these photos feature in the exhibition. And also, I mean, you were talking earlier about their popularity. It's worth remembering that for lots of people, they weren't popular. They were seen as a bit cheesy and a bit poppy. And I think even in Sweden, there was a bit of a sort of backlash from hard rockers, a bit horrified that ABBA is what people thought of when they thought of Swedish music. And we see, don't we? We see acts over a long period of time come full circle. And I think the amazing thing with ABBA is the quality of the writing was so good that in the end it was going to win through, and we were all going to realize what an amazing act they were. One of the great stories, you know, whether the power supply would be enough, you know, whether it would all work. And then at the last moment, after the win, they turned the house lights up. So suddenly there was this surge of power. And he said, you know, again, you know, they came within an inch of the whole thing exploding, which, you know, that slightly kitchen sink way that Eurovision was run. And I guess everything was run back in the 70s.
And they got a taxi to London then, and the song came on the radio and they just joined in, and the taxi driver later said that he got his own private performance of the song.
That's right. We found the taxi driver, and it's a great story. I guess when you've won Eurovision, you can afford to get a taxi to London. I'm not sure you can anymore from Brighton, but the local taxi driver took them up, stopped for petrol, and you know, people were getting out their car and recognizing them, and yeah, he got a private rendition in the back of his taxi.
Donald, what do you see as the wider cultural impact of ABBA's win?
I think it's transformative for the contest. The things that we've talked about earlier in terms of that echoing legacy that it has on future kind of performers and performances over the years is really important. I think that's really one of the catalysts for that transformation of Eurovision from, you know, that more genteel and kind of serious thing into something that is much more about the joy and fun of it. And I think a lot of the winners that we've seen over the years since then have really had that same spirit of energy that ABBA clearly have that night. And I think you were right earlier to point out the fact that they were not the favorites that night. You know, there was kind of expectations that were undone by the just raw energy that they have in that performance and how kind of transformative it was. And so I think that's one of those things that has become a kind of Eurovision trope over the years. It's one of the things that associates Sweden very strongly with Eurovision, and I'm very excited for them hosting it this year, because their hostings in the last several years have been excellent. They know the tropes of it. They know the kind of the history that they have with it as well. And I think they're very good at kind of, with tongue in cheek, reflecting on that and talking about their legacy within the competition. So lots of Irish people are very precious about our place on the pedestal with the most wins, and the fact that if Sweden get another one, they'll displace us. But I think they might deserve to do so at this point.
So, Carl, which is it? Did Eurovision help make ABBA, or did ABBA help make Eurovision?
Oh, dear. Oh, it's very hard to say. It's a symbiotic relationship, I guess, in a way. The thing with ABBA and Eurovision is that they didn't really expect to win. They saw it more as a platform for them to expose their song and themselves to the world, which was very hard for a Swedish act at the time, unless you were in Eurovision. But of course, because it's become such an iconic moment, ABBA's Eurovision victory in 1974, it's sort of become part of the ABBA story, obviously, but it's also become part of the Eurovision history. So it's kind of a marriage between those two histories, and it's been dialectic relationship where, you know, ABBA have strengthened the position. ABBA have helped strengthen Eurovision, and Eurovision have helped strengthen the story of ABBA as well.
And Carl, what do you see as their great legacy as a band? You know, just where do they stand in the pantheon of great musicians?
Today, they are absolutely regarded as one of the all-time classic bands. And that's not me as a fan saying that. It's just how it is. You now talk about the Beatles, you talk about the Stones, you talk about Bob Dylan, and you also talk about ABBA. I think they may be the biggest band on the planet now in terms of legacy acts.
And probably will be for all time, that as every generation rediscovers them, they just seem to just keep on seeming to be as strong and as powerful and as iconic as ever.
Oh, yeah, for sure. I mean, for as long as people go on listening to pop music, they will go on listening to ABBA. They're a cultural touch point.
They are a cultural touch point. Well, my thanks to my brilliant panel of experts for recreating that iconic victory of ABBA with their song Waterloo 50 years ago this month. Carl Magnus Palm, the world's leading ABBA historian and author of ABBA on Record. Hedley Swain, the CEO of the Royal Pavilion and Museums Trust, whose trust is running the ABBA exhibition ABBA One Week in Brighton at Brighton Museum. Ing-Marie Halling, the creative director and curator at ABBA the Museum in Sweden. And Dr. Donald Mulligan, who lectures at the DCU School of Communications. Well, that does bring us to the end of another edition of Talking History. My thanks to my producer, Marisa Sullivan, to Hannah Flam, who's joined us on the show for the next few weeks, to Steve Daunt on research, and to Peter Malloy on sound. We've got more debate and discussion next week, so hope you can join us then. We've been Talking History. Good night.